BookBeat is brought to you by CUNY Podcasts.
It's this sort of crazy thing because you are in a place where the stakes are life and death, where the import of what you're doing could not feel more viscerally real. And yet it happens with almost no sort of ripple in the public consciousness.
Welcome to CUNY BookBeat. I'm Joe Torella. In his new novel, Missionaries, Phil Klei, an alumnus of Hunter College's MFA in Creative Writing program and a former Marine, writes about the experiences of four people caught up in the 50-year war in Colombia. War, and the human toll it exacts, is a subject that Klei knows well. He served in Iraq during the surge, and it served as the setting for his first book, a collection of short stories called Redeployment. It won the 2014 National Book Award for Fiction, establishing Klei as a talented new voice in American fiction. In Missionaries, published by Penguin Press, Klei combines his understanding of military conflict in all its globalized, technological, and emotional complexity with an unflinching realism. He translates headlines into real-life drama, providing emotional insight into the daily lives of ordinary people who have been caught up by the extraordinary conflicts enveloping our world. As the New York Times noted in a front-page Sunday book review, Missionaries is a courageous book. It doesn't shy away, as so much fiction does, from the real world of local politics, often including real names and events, never making any concessions to a reader's potential impatience with all things foreign. It never simplifies. It doesn't even try to streamline the situation. Phil Klei, welcome to CUNY BookBeat.
Thank you so much.
For starters, one, you set your new book, Missionaries in Colombia, a country that has been at war for 50 years. But it's not a conventional war, at least for Americans, such as Vietnam or Iraq or Afghanistan. So my question is, why? What is so unique about the conflict in Colombia and America's part in it?
Sure, that led me to it. Well, I wrote my first book about Iraq, but the more that I thought about and wrote about the ways that America projects military power around the world, the more that I felt it was insufficient to just talk about one war. I wanted to talk about the ways that the wars are bound together. The interconnections between different conflicts at a point where you can have, say, a Colombian mercenary looking at on an Emirati airbase, looking at a Yemeni tribesman through a Chinese-made drone before killing him with an American-supplied missile. You know, you're talking about an interconnected level of conflict, a globalized type of conflict that I thought was important to explore. And Colombia is, in many ways, a perfect test case. It's been the largest recipient of military aid from the United States since the end of the Clinton administration. Actually, Joe Biden helped to put that package together. And there's all sorts of connections between Afghanistan, Iraq, and Colombia, tactics and ways of doing targeted killing that were sort of brought to a high level of perfection in Iraq, that were brought to Colombia. People who kept sort of ping-ponging back between Colombia and Afghanistan. Two ambassadors to Colombia post 9/11 went on to have ambassador to Afghanistan as their next posting. And also just my wife is Colombian-American, so we have relatives there, which made it very easy during the research process to, you know, take trips to Colombia, find people to interview, and so on.
Right. I wanted to talk about the global aspect of war. You know, the characters and missionaries grapple with the morality of the war that they're fighting, and if anyone cares, back home. And one takeaway for the reader is that war in the 21st century is a global enterprise. Many nations, even though it's not directly involved in combat, sell their tech or their weapons, so they play a role in the fighting, thus their citizens play a role. And what does that mean for the soldiers fighting these wars, and what does it mean for the citizens back home?
Yeah, I think that in many ways, citizens back home in a lot of Western nations have become very distant from the wars and the sort of violence that's being done on their behalf with their tax dollars that's being done by their nations. And it's The reasons for that are complex. It's a sort of mix of factors. But one of the ways that war is waged now for the United States, sort of during the Obama administration, we shifted towards a very heavy reliance on drones, on airstrikes, on special operations troops, and on technology versus sort of a larger ground presence, right? And that has proved to be politically sustainable. It stays out of the public's eye. When things do flare up, you can sort of say that you're doing things. You can point to airstrikes that you've done, people that you've killed. And yet, it's not the sort of thing that the average American feels like is a major political issue. It's not something that Congress is voting on a regular basis. And so it stays out of the public eye and out of public concern, even though the consequences of how we wage war around the globe can be enormous.
Right. Speaking of Americans at home and the reaction, that's a key element in the story of Lizette, the American journalist and novel who gets burnt out in covering the war in Afghanistan. How does that feeling of no one cares impact the soldiers on the ground?
Yeah, I think that it's this sort of crazy thing because you are in a place where the stakes are life and death, where the import of what you're doing could not feel more viscerally real. And yet it happens with almost no sort of ripple in the public consciousness. And I think that's hard to deal with. I think various different types of people deal with it in different ways. You have some folks who, for whom this is it's a profession and it's supposed to be insulated from the American public and from the sort of vicissitudes of popular opinion and so on. And there's a kind of craftsman's pride in the work. Some people, it makes them extremely alienated. For some folks, that connection back home is very important, right? And not having it makes them feel as though they're part of a separate culture, and that the culture that they come from is an alien place, and the only people they belong with are people who are concerned in the enterprise too.
One of the characters in Missionaries says that you should never go to New York straight from a combat zone, but in real life, that's exactly what you did, if I'm correct. Why is that, and what is it about New York City?
It's funny because that's actually something that a combat photographer told to me. So I described the experience of when I was in Iraq. I got 2 weeks of leave in the middle of my deployment, and my deployment, by the way, was not particularly rough, right? It was I was a staff officer. It was fine. I didn't have a particularly harsh experience whatsoever. But I had in the combat hospital that was a part of our unit, I'd seen a Marine die within about a week of coming home. And so I went from, this place where things like that were happening, to New York City. It's like beautiful weather. It's just this, extremely bustling, wealthy city. And it felt extremely bizarre to just walk down Madison Avenue and feel as though there's almost no connection with that, dusty combat hospital where that Marine died. And,
Right.
and I told that story to this combat photographer, and he was like, "Oh, yeah, you never go to New York right after a combat zone. You need some sort of steps in between, because it's just going to be too odd."
Almost like returning to what is quote unquote normal life is just too shocking.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the point is like New York is not exactly normal.
Right. No, that might be a good point there, too. Some of the characters in the novel talk about, and they watch Sylvester Stallone and Steven Seagal movies with their cartoonish depictions of violence. Do you think the violence in American pop culture desensitizes us as a nation to the real violence that is part of a war? and real violence that costs human lives, but real violence that that can be part of a real solution.
It's difficult to say, you know. I don't know whether, I mean, yeah, so the characters like Steven Seagal, and I have a little bit of fun with that in the book. I do think that the ways that we've chosen to kind of consume stories about the war is telling, about the recent wars, right? So one of the things that has been very popular in pop culture is stories of special operators, right? You know, American Sniper is this huge movie, you know, where the movie is, you know, his multiple deployments to Iraq, but it's organized around this idea of him having like a sniper battle with this enemy sniper who he finally kills at the end. You know, there are TV shows about Navy SEALs doing raids, that sort of thing. And I guess my issue with that is, you know, there's several problems. One, oftentimes when you're talking about the story of a raid or special operators troops who sort of swoop in, kill people, and then leave, the actual place where they're doing that is just background. It's just setting. You know, in American Sniper, I don't think there are any children on screen who are not actively engaged in terrorism, which, you know, I met many children who were just children in Iraq, right? It doesn't, you know, Iraq in that movie is not a place. It's a violent playground for, you know, the main character to have his, you know, sort of military and personal moral struggles. And that's one of the more complex ones, right? You know, the story of a raid is a story with a nice, neat beginning, middle, and end. It, you know, there's a bad guy out there, a bunch of warriors gear up to get him or to hunt him down. They find where he is, and then they, you know, fly in and take him out. And it's very satisfying narratively, right? But of course, as far as the current wars that we're in, you know, a neat beginning, middle, and end is exactly what we don't have. And in the book, one of the things that I did was there's a raid that happens in the middle of the book. So this is based on a real raid that the Colombian military did, where this narco-trafficker ordered a 6-foot-tall teddy bear for his girlfriend's birthday party. And the Colombian military put a beacon in it so they could track him. And they tracked a teddy bear to the birthday party and then went in and killed the guy. And rather than that being sort of what the narrative is leading up to, where after you've killed the bad guy, the book ends, that happens in the middle of the book. And then his death sort of reshuffles the power structure in the region that he's in, this area called Norte de Santander. It's a rural region of Colombia on the Venezuelan border. And there's a little town there that I focus on where, you know, it's not like once this one guy is dead that all of a sudden there's going to be good, you know, good governance and a strong state presence in this region. No, it's just going to be somebody else is going to step into the void. And it's about what happens in that region when somebody else steps into the void that is left in the wake of that killing. And that is the sort of event that precipitates all of the four characters' sort of fates becoming intertwined.
You do something very interesting in the book, and I think it's quite brave for a writer to do. Right in the middle, the first half of the novel, the four main characters tell their stories in first person. After that, the narration switches to a sort of omniscient third person narrator as the characters all come together in the central drama then that unites them. Could you explain why you made that choice?
So part of it was to start out with just the complexity of what I was trying to get across, right? I wanted to talk about all these interconnections between the different wars, how things that happen in Iraq or Afghanistan can end up affecting the life of a, you know, poor kid from a poor region of a poor department in Colombia. But in order to do that, I had to, I had to establish all the characters. I wanted to show them within, you know, in their own words, in the sort of struggling within the institutions that that structure their lives, whether, you know, it's the military, the American military, or the Colombian military, whether it's the world of journalism, whether it's, you know, this kid trying to survive in this town that has been sort of traded between left-wing guerrilla and right-wing paramilitaries and narco-traffickers his whole life. And so they all have their own kind of individual story arcs. And the first half of the book is these first-person accounts of, you know, the choices that they're making. And, you know, told that way, you know, their worlds sort of seem complete, and you sort of see the different struggles and the way that Mason is at odds with the culture of special forces and the choices he tries to make to sort of behave more ethically or in a way that he thinks will be more productive in the context of the wars. And then in the third section of the book, in the final half, essentially, of the book, it switches to a third-person voice, and the narrative sort of expands beyond, you know, these individual worldviews to include a wider social scene, and to show aspects of the conflict that aren't going to factor into, you know, these folks' decision making, and yet become determinative of what happens.
I thought it was a very brave choice, and I thought it came off extraordinarily well in the book.
Thank you.
Another topic I wanted to touch upon is you've been very vocal about your Catholic faith and missionaries set in Colombia, is a very Catholic country. Can you discuss what it means to be a Catholic writer in the 21st century, especially one who has been to and writes about war? I'm sorry, a small little question for you.
Sure. I think that... you know, it's difficult to say because everybody is going to be different. I think just whatever it is that makes you a Catholic writer would just be being a Catholic to start out with. And that's going to shape how you write. It's going to shape how you think about literature and also how you think about human beings, right? So it's not like I ever set out to write anything Catholic in particular, though those themes then crop up in my writing because it's something important to me. But I think that, you know, for one thing, a lot of the touch points that I have are writers with sort of spiritual sensibilities, Brennan Ellis, David Jones, Graham Greene, Evelyn Waugh, Walker Percy, Flannery O'Connor, T.S. Eliot, Andre Dubois II, Shusaku Endo, Hopkins, you know, so on. As far as how that works out in the fiction, you know, I think that in the characters that I write or that I want to write aren't just going to be engaged in psychological or moral struggles. I think that spiritual struggles are important too. I think they're central to human beings, whether those people are believers or not. I think that sort of community and ritual are important. I don't think you can take comfort in despair if you're a Catholic writer. I think that a sense of mystery, right, of what, you know, what can't be perfectly captured is an important part of it. So, yeah, taking the existence of evil seriously.
It's all sort of pervasive, right? The faith, there's nothing you could really encounter so important as something like this, where your faith wouldn't be touched upon, I guess.
Right.
Right. When did you know you wanted to be a writer?
I always wrote. I always loved writing. I loved reading. I think in high school, I started writing things that made me nervous to share with people because it felt like I put a lot of myself into them. And I think that's probably a good sign.
You went on to college in their MFA program. Can you tell us about your experience there and your professors?
That was incredible. So I studied with Colin McCann, Peter Carey, Claire Massoud, Patrick McGrath, and Nathan Englander. And it was just incredible. You know, you get these different writers or different sort of views on how to approach literature, how to approach writing, how they see the work. Also studying with really talented people, Bill Chang, Scott Cheshire, and Caitlin Greenidge, and Lauren Holmes. You know, so I was surrounded by other writers who were producing really high quality work and who were reading my work and giving me feedback on it and pushing me. And, you know, I still keep in touch with a lot of those folks. Actually, Bill Chang and I touch base every Sunday to see how our week of writing has gone. So we keep each other honest.
What year did you graduate?
2011.
Speaking of your first book, Redeployment, a short story collection, it won a National Book Award. That has to be both a wonderful feeling and surreal at the same time, I would imagine.
It's, yeah, it was totally surreal. I mean, yeah, I did not expect to win. I didn't even write a speech until that morning when my wife made me. You know, she asked me if I'd written one. I said, no, I'm not going to win. She was like, you have to write a speech. Yeah, it was incredible. It was incredible. And it meant that the book went into the hands of a lot more readers, which I'm very grateful for.
You're on the faculty at Fairfield University in Connecticut.
I am.
And you teach in their MFA program.
Yes.
What do you tell your students who want to write, and someone who just comes to an MFA program rather young, let's say, and wants to start a writing career and dive into it? What kind of advice do you give to writers or your students?
Yeah, well, so Fairfield is a low residency MFA. So actually, we have, you know, I get writers of a range of ages, which is one of the nice things about Fairfield. But I think that, I mean, the primary thing is, you know, sort of the work comes first. I think this is it's a difficult job. It's a difficult job to make a living doing this. So the first, you know, the kind of primary drive has to be the work, has to be the drive to communicate, to sort of express exactly what it is that you need to express. Has to be, you know, the sort of primary satisfaction first and foremost. And then, you know, we can have sort of nuts and bolts conversations about, you know, how you go about trying to make this work practically. But, you know, it's one of those things where if you want, you know, if you want a secure path forward, writing is not the way to go. But it is, I think, you know, sort of learning to hone your craft is not just learning to write better stories, but it's learning to communicate more fully what is most important to you in the world. And so I don't think there could be a better thing to do.
My last question is about Veterans Day, which is quickly approaching. There seems to be a real worship of veterans in this country where they're sort of put on a pedestal. And I wonder if being elevated in that way is actually a help to them and the issues they may encounter when they return home from a place like an Iraq or an Afghanistan. And have you any thoughts on that?
Yeah, there's a kind of dichotomy in the culture where you either sort of assume that veterans are heroes, or sometimes you assume that they're damaged, right? And defective in some way. I remember being told by a guy at a bar that all Iraq vets were going to snap after 10 years. And I'd been back 3 years at that point. So, you know, I had 7 years left. He wasn't trying to be mean. He's trying to let me know, so I guess I could plan those 7 years. Though, you know, I've been back. Let's see, my 10 year back from Iraq was in 2018. So, I guess I can leave it to the listeners to decide whether I snapped or not. But and then yeah, and then on the other side, there's this sort of kind of, you know, troops as this kind of heroes, or this sort of symbol of, you know, pure American patriotism or whatever. And, you know, I think that is, in some ways, it's a function of how rare it is that some people within some communities meet veterans, right? It's a very small number of people who serve. And so, you know, they get treated not as human beings doing a job, right? But as some, you know, sort of existing in some other space. And that's not healthy, whether, you know, whether it's glorifying them or not. It makes it more difficult to have sort of real conversations about, you know, their experiences in the military, whether those are good or bad. It makes it more difficult for them to feel known by the communities that they come back to.
Phil, I want to thank you for taking the time for doing this.
Thank you.
For more BookBeat, visit CUNY Podcasts at cuny.edu/podcasts.